Thank you for being an amazing supporter of the 10X Podcast Group, home to the history of the Caribbeans. We're excited to have you as a valued member of our growing community. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Your likes, comments, and reviews mean so much to us. They help us reach a wider audience and inspire us to keep sharing these incredible stories. With new episodes released daily, your feedback plays a crucial role in shaping our content and making it even better. Your dedication and enthusiasm drive our mission to document and celebrate the rich history of the Caribbean. We're deeply grateful for your support. Today, we're thrilled to present Curaçao Episode 1, a captivating story tracing the journey from the island's earliest settlers to the present day. So sit back, relax, and join us as we guide you through this fascinating chapter in Caribbean history. Enjoy the journey. Chapter 1, The First Footprints, the Arawak and Kikisio Tribes. Before the rise of bustling harbors and towering colonial fortresses, before the echoes of war and the march of European ambition, Curaçao was a land of unbroken silence, shaped by the steady rhythm of wind and waves. The island, cradled in the warm arms of the Caribbean Sea, stood as an untouched gem, kissed by the salty breeze and guarded by rugged cliffs. Yet even in its solitude, Curaçao was never truly empty. Long before the arrival of foreign sails cutting across the horizon, before the first musket fire shattered the stillness of the shore, there were people, those who belonged to the land as much as the land belonged to them. They were the Kikisio, a branch of the Arawak people who had crossed the waters from the northern coast of South America centuries before the first European gaze ever fell upon the Caribbean. Nomadic at first, they were seafarers and adventurers, their dugout canoes slicing through the waves with quiet determination. Some say they were guided by the stars. Others believe it was necessity that pushed them to leave the dense rainforests of the mainland and settle on the islands scattered like stepping stones across the sea. Curaçao was one of these lands, a place of abundance, yet demanding in its own way. The soil was dry, less fertile than the rich river valleys of their ancestors, but the island was kind in other ways. The ocean teemed with fish, the land bore wild fruits, and the sky was open, vast, and free. They built their villages in clusters, thatched roofs peeking from between clusters of towering DVDV trees, their curved branches whispering secrets to the wind. The Kikisio people were craftsmen, storytellers, and warriors, their lives woven into the land like the tightly bound fibers of their woven hammocks. They were expert farmers, cultivating cassava, sweet potatoes, and maize in patches of tilled earth, though their true sustenance came from the sea. Fishing was an art, a skill passed down through generations. Nets woven from palm fibers sank beneath the waves, returning heavy with silver-scaled bounty. Spears tipped with sharpened bones struck true beneath the surface, their wielders moving with a grace that spoke of generations bound to the water. Theirs was a world defined by rhythm, the rhythm of the tides, the cycles of the sun, the measured chants of their spiritual leaders as they called upon the spirits of their ancestors. They believed in a balance between the world of the living and the unseen forces that watched over them. The shamans, respected figures within the tribe, would often gather their people beneath the sacred trees, their voices low and melodic as they spoke of the great spirits who shaped the land. Firelight flickered against their painted faces as they told stories of creation, of how the sky and the sea had once been lovers, separated by a jealous god, and how the first people were born from the tears of the ocean itself. But Curaçao was not without its dangers. The island was a realm of survival, where droughts could steal the life from crops, where jagged coral reefs could claim the lives of even the most seasoned fishermen. The Kikisio were resilient, but they were also watchful. They had known for generations that they were not alone in this vast, untamed world. From time to time, raiders would come from the sea, Carib warriors fierce and unyielding, their war canoes slicing through the waves like shadows. The Caribs, known for their brutality, were said to consume the flesh of their enemies, a belief that sent chills through the villages whenever their sails appeared on the horizon. When the Caribs came, the Kikisio fought. They did not have iron, nor the steel blades that would one day be brought by the Spanish, but they had bows, arrows tipped with poison drawn from the sap of jungle plants, and clubs carved from the hardest of woods. Battles were waged on the shores of Curaçao, where the turquoise waters ran red under the unforgiving sun. Sometimes the Kikisio repelled their foes. Other times, their people were taken, stolen in the night, their cries swallowed by the darkness as they were carried away to foreign lands, never to return. Yet the Kikishio endured. They adapted to the land, learning to survive its harsh seasons and cherish its gifts. They carved petroglyphs into the island's rocky caves, etching their stories into stone so that even long after their voices had faded, their mark upon the land would remain. These carvings, hidden in the depths of Curaçao's rugged terrain, still whisper their stories to those who care to listen. For centuries, Curaçao was their world, untouched by the greed and ambition of foreign powers. But all of that was about to change. The first whispers of a storm had begun to ripple across the waters of the Atlantic. In lands far away, men with pale skin and hunger in their eyes were setting sail, their wooden ships bound for a world they did not yet understand. And so, one fateful day in 1499, a new kind of sail appeared on the horizon, one that would forever alter the fate of the Kikishio, of Curaçao, and of the Caribbean itself. The age of discovery had begun, and for the people of this land, it would be an age of loss, resilience, and survival. Chapter 2. The arrival of the Spanish, 1499, the beginning of a new world. The waves had always carried stories, whispers of distant lands, legends of gods and monsters, and the prayers of men who feared the unknown. But in the late 15th century, the Caribbean was about to bear witness to a different kind of story, one that would not be carried on the breeze like folklore, but etched in blood and conquest. The world as the indigenous Kikishio people knew it was on the precipice of change, though they could not yet see the shadows creeping over the horizon. It began with a ship, wooden, towering, an unnatural beast upon the waters. It appeared like a phantom from the sea, unfamiliar to those who had spent generations navigating these waters in their sturdy canoes. The year was 1499, and at the helm of this vessel stood a man who saw the world not through the eyes of wonder, but of conquest, Alonso de Ojeda, a Spanish explorer, hardened by war and hungry for land. He had sailed under the banner of the Spanish crown, driven by the promise of riches, of gold, and of power. By his side was a cartographer named Juan de la Cosa, and an ambitious young Italian named Amerigo Vespucci, whose name would one day become synonymous with the New World. But for now, they were just men on a mission, to map, to claim, and to take. The sight of Curaçao's rugged cliffs and sunlit shores may have appeared to them as nothing more than another conquest in a string of nameless islands. They did not see the spiritual significance that these lands held for the Kikishio people. They did not see the stories woven into the rocks, nor hear the songs carried by the wind. They only saw opportunity. Ojeda's ships did not come bearing gifts. They carried steel, fire, and an unwavering belief in their divine right to rule. To the Spanish, Curaçao was a piece of land waiting to be consumed by the vast appetite of the empire. But to the Kikishio people, these strange men were something else entirely. They were spirits, gods perhaps, or demons born from the sea itself. First encounters, the meeting of two worlds. The Kikishio had seen unusual sights before. They were skilled navigators, traveling in dugout canoes as far as the shores of South America, and they were no strangers to the arrival of foreigners. But these men were different. They did not arrive like traders or allies. They arrived like invaders. At first, there was curiosity. The Kikishio observed them from the cliffs, hidden among the trees, their bodies painted with the earth, their movements silent. They watched as the Spanish disembarked, stepping onto sacred ground with boots made of leather and iron, speaking a language that rolled like thunder from their tongues. A chief, adorned with feathers and beads, stepped forward, flanked by warriors. He held out his hands, not in surrender, but in offering. To the indigenous people of the Caribbean, hospitality was sacred. Strangers were to be fed, given water, and if they proved themselves worthy, perhaps even welcomed into the tribe. But the Spanish were not men of hospitality. They were men of hunger, and their appetites could not be sated with food alone. At first, there was peace. The Spanish accepted the gifts, fruits, woven cloth, fish fresh from the sea. But their eyes searched for something else. Gold. They asked for it, demanded it, and when the Kikishio could not provide it, the mood changed. These men, who had arrived with smiles and gestures of diplomacy, now reached for their weapons. What followed was a test of power, a moment that would define the fate of Curaçao for centuries to come. The Kikishio were warriors, strong and swift, their bows drawn, their spears sharpened. They had fought before against rival tribes, against the harshness of nature itself. But they had never fought against steel, against gunpowder, against the wrath of an empire. The first shot rang out, splitting the silence like a crack of lightning. The aftermath, a land named, a people stolen. The battle was short-lived. Outnumbered, outmatched, and unfamiliar with the power of European weapons, the Kikishio warriors fell one by one. Those who survived were bound in chains. Some were taken as prisoners, forced onto the Spanish ships, their wrists raw from iron shackles. Others fled into the mountains, becoming ghosts of the land they once ruled. Ojeda, satisfied with his claim, named the island. Curaçao, some say, was derived from the Portuguese word coraço, meaning heart, because of the island's importance as a stopping point for trade. Others believe the name was born from a more tragic story, the Cured Ones, referring to enslaved indigenous people who had been abandoned on the island and later found alive, giving the island its name. Either way, the Kikishio's presence was reduced to a whisper in history, their voices drowned by the tide of colonization. Those taken by the Spanish were shipped off to Hispaniola, where they were enslaved and forced to work in the brutal gold mines of the Spanish colonies. Their once proud civilization was shattered, their people scattered, their names forgotten. But their spirit never truly left. It lived on in the winds that howled through the canyons, in the soil beneath the Spanish boots, in the bloodlines that would one day shape the future of Curaçao. The legacy of the Spanish arrival. The Spanish did not stay long in Curaçao. It was not the paradise they had dreamed of, no gold, no fertile land rich for planting. They abandoned the island, leaving behind only the scars of their conquest. But their impact was irreversible. They had opened the door to something much larger, the European hunger for the Caribbean. As the Spanish Empire stretched across the seas, their rivals watched with envious eyes. And in the years to come, another power would set its sights on Curaçao, one that would forever change the island's destiny. But before the Dutch, before the pirates, before the oil refineries and the bustling ports, there were those who had called this land home. And even as the world around them shifted and empires rose and fell, the whispers of the Kikishio people remained, carried in the winds, in the rhythms of the waves, and in the unbroken spirit of the island. Chapter 3, Dutch Takeover, 1634. The Battle for the Caribbean. The Caribbean Sea had always been a battleground, not just of ships and soldiers, but of empires, ambitions, and unyielding greed. For over a century after the Spanish had first claimed Curaçao, the island lay in a state of abandonment, a forgotten jewel in the vast expanse of Spain's dominions. It was not the lush paradise the Spaniards had hoped for. No fields of gold, no easy wealth to extract. And so, like a discarded trinket, they left it behind. But the world was changing. The 17th century saw Europe consumed by conflict, its powerful nations locked in a relentless struggle for dominance over the seas. The Spanish Empire, once untouchable, was now beset by enemies on all sides. Its fleets were stretched thin, its colonies vulnerable. And where Spain faltered, others saw opportunity. In the north, the Dutch Republic, a young but fiercely ambitious nation, had begun its ascent as a maritime powerhouse. The Dutch did not seek empires in the traditional sense. They sought trade, wealth, and control of the world's commerce. And in the eyes of the Dutch West India Company, WIC, Curaçao was not just an island. It was a gateway to the riches of the Caribbean. The plan for conquest, the Dutch West India Company's ambition. By the early 1600s, the Dutch had already taken the fight to Spain, launching a series of calculated attacks against Spanish holdings in the New World. They had established control over key trading posts in Brazil, Suriname, and parts of the Caribbean. But to truly disrupt Spanish hegemony, they needed a strategic naval outpost, a place to harbor their fleets, stage raids, and dominate the Caribbean's trade routes. Curaçao was that place. And so, in the summer of 1634, a fleet of Dutch warships set sail from the Netherlands, led by the ruthless and determined Admiral Johan van Walbeek. With him were hundreds of seasoned sailors, battle-hardened mercenaries, and merchants who saw Curaçao not as a home, but as an asset. They did not come with treaties or diplomacy. They came to take what they wanted. The battle for Curaçao, Dutch fire meets Spanish steel. The Spanish, though neglectful of the island, had not left it entirely defenseless. A small Spanish garrison still occupied Curaçao, tasked with keeping an eye on the surrounding waters. They had cannons positioned along the cliffs, a few wooden fortifications, and a force of less than 200 soldiers. But they were unprepared for what was coming. On July 29, 1634, Van Walbeek's fleet descended upon the island like a storm. The Dutch ships, armed with rows of cannons, opened fire on the coastline, sending explosions of rock and earth into the air. The thunder of artillery echoed across the bay as Spanish soldiers scrambled to defend their post. Van Walbeek knew that the key to controlling the island was capturing its main Spanish stronghold, Santa Barbara. This was no grand stone fortress. It was a simple but strategic outpost perched on high ground. If the Spanish lost it, they would lose Curaçao. The Dutch landed at St. Anna Bay, their muskets loaded, their sabers drawn. Smoke filled the air as Spanish and Dutch forces clashed in brutal close-quarters combat. Blood soaked the earth, the cries of wounded men blending with the roar of gunfire. For hours, the battle raged. The Spanish, though outnumbered, fought fiercely, knowing that surrender meant losing the island forever. But the Dutch had superior weapons, better-trained soldiers, and an unrelenting will to win. By nightfall, the Spanish were in retreat. Those who survived fled into the hills, abandoning their positions. Santa Barbara fell, and with it so did Spanish rule over Curaçao. Curaçao under Dutch control, a new era begins. The following morning, the Dutch flag was raised over Curaçao for the first time. It flapped defiantly in the Caribbean wind, a symbol of a new era. The island, once a forgotten outpost, was now a prized possession of the Dutch West India Company. For the Dutch, Curaçao was not meant to be a colony in the traditional sense. It was meant to be a center for trade, piracy, and profit. The WIC wasted no time in transforming the island into a thriving hub of commerce and military strategy. Fort Amsterdam was built at the entrance of St. Anna Bay, ensuring that no Spanish or enemy ship could enter without Dutch permission. But perhaps the most significant transformation was yet to come. The arrival of the slave trade, Curaçao's darkest industry. The Dutch had taken Curaçao not just for its strategic location, but for its potential as a slave depot. By the mid-1600s, the transatlantic slave trade was booming and Curaçao, with its deep natural harbors, was perfectly positioned to become a key player in this brutal industry. Ships carrying enslaved Africans soon began arriving from the west coast of Africa, their human cargo chained in the darkness of the hull. These men, women, and children were torn from their homes, their bodies marked by the scars of whips and iron shackles. For many, Curaçao was not a final destination, but a place of transit, a brutal market where they would be bought, sold, and sent to the sugar plantations of the Caribbean and South America. For those who remained on the island, life was one of unrelenting suffering. The Dutch, like the Spanish before them, saw the enslaved not as people, but as property. They were forced to work under the burning sun, building roads, cultivating crops, and laboring in the growing settlements. Yet, even in the depths of despair, the enslaved found ways to resist. Some fled into the hills, forming hidden communities of runaways, known as Maroons. Others resisted through small acts of defiance, clinging to their languages, their traditions, and their spirits, ensuring that their identities would never be fully erased. The seeds of change, Curaçao's future under Dutch rule. With the Dutch firmly in control, Curaçao entered a new phase of its history, one marked by economic expansion, cultural transformation, and simmering tensions that would one day erupt into revolution. In the coming decades, Willemstad would rise as a powerful Caribbean trade city, its colorful buildings and winding streets reflecting the fusion of Dutch, African, and Caribbean influences. The Jewish community, seeking refuge from persecution in Europe, would find a home on the island, shaping its commerce and culture. The enslaved population would grow, and so would their resistance, setting the stage for future revolts that would shake the island's foundations. The Spanish were gone, but their shadow lingered. Curaçao had fallen into new hands, but the struggle for true freedom was far from over. And so, as the Dutch West India Company tightened its grip, as forts were built and trade routes expanded, the island stood on the precipice of a new kind of battle, one that would not be fought with muskets, but with the unbreakable spirit of its people. Curaçao belonged to the Dutch now. But for how long? Chapter 4. The Slave Trade and the Rise of Willemstad, 1662-1700s. The conquest of Curaçao by the Dutch West India Company, WIC, in 1634 had been swift and brutal, but the real transformation of the island was yet to begin. The Dutch had not come to establish a colony of farmers or to extract gold from the earth. They had come to turn Curaçao into an empire of commerce. And in the 17th century, there was no commodity more valuable, no business more profitable, than the trade of human lives. Curaçao, with its deep harbors, Its strategic location at the crossroads of the Caribbean and its proximity to the vast plantations of South America and the West Indies was the perfect depot for the transatlantic slave trade. It was not the lush sugar colonies of Barbados or Jamaica, nor the gold-rich hills of Colombia, but it did not need to be. Curaçao was a hub, a place where men, women, and children were bought and sold like cargo, fueling the economies of the New World. The expansion of the Dutch slave trade. By the 1660s, the Dutch West India Company had already established itself as one of the major players in the transatlantic slave trade. After the Netherlands had briefly seized control of parts of Brazil, Dutch merchants gained direct access to the West African coast, where powerful African kingdoms such as the Congo and Dahomey captured and sold prisoners of war to European traders. From the infamous slave forts of Elmina and Gori, thousands of Africans were crammed into the dark, airless holds of Dutch ships, branded like cattle, and sent across the vast, merciless ocean. The Middle Passage, as it came to be known, was a journey of unimaginable suffering. Chained together in the stifling heat, stripped of their names, their languages, their dignity, they lay in their own filth, waiting to die. Many did. Those who survived would never see their homelands again. By 1662, Curaçao had officially become one of the largest slave markets in the Caribbean. Ships arrived filled with enslaved men, women, and children from Africa, and they were then auctioned off to plantation owners from across the Americas. To sugar plantations in the Spanish Main, coffee farms in Suriname, tobacco fields in Cuba, and cotton plantations in Saint-Domingue, Haiti. The auctions were held in Willemstad, the growing settlement at the heart of Curaçao. Buyers would inspect the enslaved, checking their teeth, feeling their muscles, deciding which ones were worth a high price and which ones were too weak to work. Children were torn from their mothers, husbands from their wives, families ripped apart without hesitation or remorse. For the WIC, it was a business transaction. For those being sold, it was the destruction of everything they had ever known. The birth of Willemstad, a city built on blood. As the slave trade flourished, so too did Willemstad, the port city that would become the economic heart of Curaçao. Located along the natural harbor of St. Anna Bay, Willemstad grew rapidly, its streets bustling with merchants, traders, and ships from every corner of the world. By the late 1600s, Willemstad had become one of the busiest ports in the Caribbean. It was here that Dutch, Portuguese, Spanish, and Jewish traders built their fortunes, using enslaved labor to construct buildings, warehouses, and docks. The city was divided into districts. Punda, the oldest part, where the wealthiest Dutch merchants and administrators lived, protected by the newly built Fort Amsterdam. Outrabanda, which developed later, housing the free black community, Creoles, and working-class European immigrants. Charleroi, which would eventually become home to wealthy Jewish merchants who played a key role in Curaçao's trade economy. The architecture of Willemstad, with its colorful Dutch-style gabled buildings, was a reflection of the Netherlands, a reminder that even here, thousands of miles from Europe, Curaçao was still under Dutch rule. But the true foundation of Willemstad was not its architecture. It was the backs of the enslaved people who built its streets, its homes, its fortresses. They were forced to carry stones under the scorching sun, to labor in the warehouses, to load and unload goods from the countless ships that came to Curaçao's shores. They were the invisible workforce that made Willemstad the jewel of the Dutch Caribbean. The role of the Sephardic Jewish community. During this period, Curaçao also became a haven for Sephardic Jews, many of whom had fled persecution in Spain and Portugal and had found refuge in the Netherlands. In Curaçao, Jewish merchants played a critical role in the island's trade, including the slave trade. They were skilled businessmen, fluent in multiple languages, and connected to vast commercial networks stretching from Amsterdam to the Americas. In 1651, the first Jewish settlers arrived, establishing the Mikveh Israel Emanuel Synagogue, which remains the oldest synagogue in continuous use in the Western Hemisphere. Many Jewish merchants became plantation owners, bankers, and exporters of goods, helping Curaçao cement its status as a Caribbean trade hub. Though some Jewish merchants participated in the slave trade, others later became advocates for abolition, playing complex and sometimes contradictory roles in Curaçao's history. Resistance, rebellion, and the fight for freedom. But Curaçao was not merely a place of commerce and suffering. It was also a land of resistance. Throughout the late 1600s and early 1700s, enslaved people on Curaçao fought back in every way they could. Some fled into the hills, forming maroon communities that survived off the land, refusing to live in chains. Others practiced silent resistance, slowing down work, breaking tools, speaking their native African languages in defiance of their Dutch captors. Some fought with their own lives, attacking their overseers, setting fire to plantations, and attempting to seize ships to escape the island. The Dutch, fearing uprisings, enacted brutal laws to keep the enslaved in submission. Flogging, mutilation, and public executions were common punishments for those who tried to escape. Those caught aiding runaways were whipped or even executed. Yet, despite the horrors, the spirit of resistance never died. The seeds of rebellion were already being planted, seeds that would bloom into full revolt in the years to come. Curaçao at the turn of the century, a changing island. By the early 1700s, Curaçao was one of the wealthiest trading hubs in the Caribbean, but it was also one of the most unequal. The Dutch elite grew richer, expanding their trade empires. The Jewish community flourished, bringing culture, innovation, and financial networks. But the enslaved people suffered, their lives dictated by cruelty, labor, and survival. Yet, beneath the surface, the world was changing. The Atlantic slave trade was becoming more controversial. The African diaspora was growing stronger, forging new cultures and identities despite their suffering. And the idea of freedom, though still distant, was beginning to take root in the hearts of the enslaved. Curaçao had become a center of power, wealth, and brutality. But history had already shown that empires built on oppression do not last forever. The next century would bring war, rebellion, and change. And the enslaved people of Curaçao would not remain silent forever.